Good morning, Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN, and she's back, veterinary behaviorist Dr. Christine Calder, this time around low-stress handling, a practical guide, and by the way, it is a practical guide, to cooperative care, training, and behavior modification. We'll explain what cooperative care is. In very simple terms, it's a way in which you can brush your dog or cat's teeth at home, and your dog or cat really won't mind the experience, or clip nails, or say, go to the carrier because we're going to the veterinarian, any of those things. Previously, it was just a couple of months ago, Dr. Calder was right here talking about Dr. Sophia Yin's low stress handling and behavior modification of dogs and cats, second edition, and she's back already. Is it that you weren't able to fit everything in the first book? I mean, you're back already. Do you apparently don't rest at all, Dr. Calder?
No, sometimes I wonder if I get to rest. No, no. Thank you so much for bringing me back. And you are absolutely correct. This book, it would not fit in the first book. Well, it would have, but then our first book would have been about 700 plus pages. So we made the decision to take some of the chapters out. And really what our goal was to divide the book into two. So we have the why, which is the second edition, and now we have the how. So we told you all about why we do the things that we do and how we can prevent behavioral issues, how we can work with patients in the hospital, and the theories behind what fear is, anxiety, frustration, how that affects behavior. But now what we're doing is highlighting the how. This is how we do this. This is how we do the cooperative care. This is how we do the training. And then we even give you recipes on how to actually do it with a step-by-step guide.
And I'm going to make
that was
you
kind of our goal. Yes.
And I will make you offer some of those recipes. I want to go back though to the first book, Dr. Sophia Yin's Low Stress Handling and Behavior Modification of Dogs and Cats, second edition. And the reason is a topic that has come up that I think is exceedingly important to talk about. But before we do that, the name of the book is Dr. Sophia Yin's Low Stress Handling and Behavior Modification of Dogs and Cats. Let's talk about Dr. Sophia Yin. Her name is in the book. She passed away several years ago, and I'd like you to talk about who she was and what her impact was and why you feel it's important to stick her name on the book.
Yes, Sophia was amazing. She was a veterinarian. She was a behaviorist. And she really started, to raise that level of awareness many, many years ago. The first book that she wrote was published in 2009. So, she really is the foundation, and her program is the foundation for many of these, newer programs that we see today when we're talking about, how to be patient-centered or behavior-friendly in the veterinary hospital. But Sophia was the one who started it all with her low-stress handling, way back in 2000, 2009. She created a program, a certification that, there's nothing like it even to today. It's still very, very applicable to, practice and not just practice, but also shelters, trainers, pet caregivers. I mean, everybody. She really, education was, her goal, and she wanted to make sure it was accessible for everyone so that to make the lives better for pets and their people.
Well, I'm a little offended that, 2009 you said that you're referring to 2009 as kind of the dark ages, but that's another story. So something has happened that I'm sure you're aware of in the world of dog training, and I've been talking a lot about this because I think it is – we're at a crossroads now, and your voice being a veterinary behaviorist, I mean, not only are you a veterinarian, so therefore aware of – any impact physically to any animal, but also you are a behaviorist and you don't get to be one just because you want to say it's a good idea. Any veterinary behaviorist works very, very hard. You and your colleagues, in my view, are top of the line when it comes to animal behavior. Right there, end of story. And let me talk about what has happened here. So the Certification Council for Professional Dog Trainers has said we want across the board to be consistency and licensing among dog trainers, which in my view sounds good, except what they've done is they've said it's okay. Instead of saying we want the best practices, it's okay to use a shock collar or e-collar. It's okay to use a prong collar. Those are the pointy things that point into the dogs, if you don't know. And it's okay for you to use a chain link or choke collar. So my question to you is, what do you think of this? Is it okay?
No. That's the short answer. No, it is not okay. I mean, you know, the risk is very high that you're going to have side effects, and those are going to be emotional fallout and emotional side effects. I mean, you know, these tools, they work by, you know, punishing the dog for making the wrong decision. And so, you know, they're not really teaching the dog what to do, and they're not really teaching the dog or changing how the dog feels about something. And so, you know, and I think that's really important, is that a lot of behavior is motivated by how they feel. And if we are punishing them for feeling a certain way, what we tend to do is we tend to escalate that fear, anxiety, frustration, and we can have some emotional fallout. They can withdraw. It can affect their relationship with humans. I mean, there really is no reason to use these types of tools. They really don't have a place in training. They definitely don't have a place in behavior modification. And there are so many other ways in which we can approach, you know, these cases. And there's so many other ways in which we can change behavior that doesn't rely on force, that doesn't rely on fear, that doesn't rely on pain. And I think that's something that's really important. And I know people, you know, they reach for the shock collars because they're easy, or they think they're easy, and they're looking for a quick fix. But they're, you know, when it comes to changing behavior, there are no quick fixes. And so, you know, it really can be a quality of life, and it can affect the outcome of what happens in the long run. I mean, as a veterinary behaviorist, I see so many cases where, you know, these things have been tried, these tools have been tried, and the behavior hasn't changed. And in fact, it's gotten worse. And so, you know, they're just really not appropriate. And then it makes our job as a veterinary behaviorist and trainers much harder to reverse, you know, the damage, the emotional damage that has been done from using these particular tools.
And I want to ask you when we come back about the notion that, okay, I'm a professional trainer, I know how to do this, and I just go to a certain point to shock the dog, and I know what I'm doing, and therefore it's okay because I'm just shocking a little bit. Does that make sense? We'll talk about that, and we will talk about the science behind everything you're talking about. It's not only your opinion, Dr. Christine Calder, veterinary behaviorist, but we know today everything you said is true regarding concerns about using this equipment. And we'll talk, I promise, about low-stress handling, a practical guide to cooperative care training and behavior modification when we come back on WGN. In the first book, the first book is called Dr. Sophia Yin's Low-Stress Handling and Behavior Modification of Dogs and Cats, Second Edition. And in that book, Veterinary Behaviors, Dr. Christine Calder, you write about what equipment should not be used. But you're not alone. I have several veterinary textbooks, several, authored or edited or both by your colleagues. And they all say the same thing, which in essence is you're going to do far more harm than good using a shock collar or an e-collar. Do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely agree with that. There's just no place for them.
But what if that trainer says, that dog, I've got a choice here. That dog is aggressive. So either that dog is going to be euthanized, or I can change the behavior using a shock collar. What is your reply to that? I'm sure you've heard that many times.
I've heard that many times, and I've actually also worked in the sheltering world, and I mean, there are many things that you can do that will change that behavior and also can help to save that animal without using that shock collar. You know, first thing is understanding why the behavior is happening in the first place. You know, when we're using things like these shock collars, we're not getting to the root of the problem. We're not getting to the root of the issue. And so, you know, all we're really doing is masking the communication signals from that dog. And so we don't want to do that. We want to understand why it's happening. We want to get to the root of why it's happening. And then we can make some meaningful changes. And you know, there's many options that we have other than putting a shock collar on that animal.
Well, there are many options. So what I tend to say is that, okay, maybe 25 years ago, I'm not saying shock collars were ever a good idea, but I get it. 25 years ago, you didn't have as many options. We didn't understand as much, or maybe 30 years ago, whatever that number is. We didn't understand as much about behavior modification. We didn't understand as much about learning theory. And most of all, I'd argue, we didn't have you. We didn't have veterinary behaviorists who today understand how to use psychopharmaceuticals. And what strikes me are all the pet owners who say, I don't want to drug my dog or cat because I don't want them doped up. I don't want another personality, which, by the way, of course, you know, is not the case when you have a professional overseeing everything. That's not going to happen. What it does is this adjusts the brain chemistry to make learning possible. So 30 years ago, we didn't know about what to use or not use. We didn't have the expertise that you have. But today, to me, there should be an entirely different way of thinking because we can think differently about it.
Mm-hmm. Very true. Yes, we also didn't have the research, You know, over the past 10, 15 years, the amount of research that has, you know, gone into looking at pharmaceuticals, looking at training techniques, looking at behavior in general has grown immensely. And our understanding of, you know, not only how these animals think, but also how they learn, you know, has also grown. So, you know, these are the things that, you know, we have more. We're practicing more evidence-based medicine, and that's one of the things that I think is really important because, no, we didn't have all of that, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, and now we do. And so there's so many other options that we have in so many other avenues. And you're right about medications. I mean, you know, medications are not something that we necessarily want to avoid, but it's not something we necessarily jump right on either. I mean, we've got to make an assessment first, but medications can play a very important role. They're not going to cure the animal. They're not going to change the behavior alone, but they can be an important tool in that process so that we can help to improve the learning capability and the learning ability of that, or the learning potential of that particular animal as well, so that they can learn what we're teaching them or working through with behavior modification. So they're an adjunct or an addition, but they're not going to be a standalone. But they can be very beneficial.
You know, I wrote a story about this. I'd have to look it up. I don't remember the exact number. But so many people say, I don't want to put my dog or cat, it's often a dog we're talking about, though, on a drug. And those people themselves are on a psychopharmaceutical. I believe that it is well over half of the American public, right, wrong, or otherwise, are on some sort of psychoactive or psychopharmaceutical drug. Yet there's a resistance to do this with dogs or cats. Have you experienced the same?
Oh, definitely, yes. It's a conversation, you know, that we frequently have. And cats, too, you have to think about, you know, we don't want to forget the cats, but, you know, sometimes it can be a little more challenging to administer medications, too.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, we do take that into account. But, no, you're exactly right. There's so many humans that are okay with this, but for some reason they're not okay for their pets. But, you know, medications can help improve quality of life, not only for the pet, but for their people as well. So, you know, I do think that's something to seriously consider. And our goal when using medications is not to change who they are. We're not changing personalities. We're not sedating them. You know, we're just helping them cope a little bit better in these environments and in these situations that they find emotionally overwhelming.
Now, what about the idea that the dog trainer says, well, I know what I'm doing. I'm a professional. I know how far to go with the shock, or the jolt. I don't know the right. Those aren't words they'd want me to use, those trainers, but that's really what's going on here. And they say they know how far to go. One, Zach George, dog trainer, said, and I think it's a great analogy. It's like saying, okay, smoke X number of cigarettes a day instead of 4 packs a day, smoke 2 packs a day or something. I'm not sure that that's a perfect analogy, but I think that's a good analogy myself. Is there any way to say, okay, it's okay if you know what you're doing, if you only shock your dog a little bit, it's acceptable?
Yeah, no, I find that most people don't have that. They don't. It's hard to make that decision, and each dog, and we're talking about dogs, is an individual, and how they're going to be perceived that. So really, you know, even from our perception or our perspective, it doesn't matter as much as what the perspective is of that dog. And you know, some dogs are very sensitive, and some dogs are a little less sensitive, but even still, it's hard to make those decisions, and it's hard to make those assessments. And no, there really, I don't think there is an okay to use that, no matter what level that you're putting that shock collar on. It just isn't appropriate, and on some level it's affecting them. Whether or not you're going to see a direct result of that, you may not, but there may be some very subtle signs that you may not notice. And things like, you know, they don't make direct eye contact, or maybe their ears go back, you know, looking at the body language. And most people aren't very, very, they just don't know how to read body language. And so they don't notice these types of things that, you know, we may notice if we're watching or looking at it from an outside perspective. And so I think it's really hard for most people to really determine whether or not that's causing pain or discomfort with their pet. So I don't think it's appropriate to be using that. And to be honest with you, trainers, there's certifications that they really should go through. And so, you know, even if they've been training for 20 years, 15 years, 20 years or more, it doesn't make them necessarily expert trainers. There's actually programs or certifications that can really elevate that level of understanding and really their skill set as trainers. And I think that's important as well, is looking for credentials for these trainers and making sure that you're working with professionals who have been credentialed and have gone through these standardized programs that are using the most evidence-based or best methods for helping training and also behavior modification of your pet.
Yeah, but in a word, yes or no, are you disappointed with what I said regarding the Certification Council for Professional Dog Trainers?
In terms of if I'm worried about the certification of trainers, no, I think there is appropriate. I think for trainers, I think that licensing a trainer, I think, is a good idea.
Yep.
I don't know that we're there yet, though.
Yeah, not if they say it's okay to use shock collars. That's what I'm asking.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
All right.
Exactly right. Yes. No. Right. Exactly. No. I think that when it comes to licensing, I think it's important because, you know, as a veterinarian, I have to be licensed, right? I have to take certain certifications. I have to have a certain education. I have to take exams.
And trainers,
you know, there's a standardized process to it.
Right. Trainers yep. And it should be the same. I've got a break, but we'll be right back with Dr. Christine Calder. Bob Walker is a photographer, and several years ago, many years ago at this point, he had a beautiful book out. It was called A Cat's House, and that's literally, his house was the cat's house. I don't remember how many cats were in this house, 6, 7, 8, I don't remember, but he had all these platforms and shelves and places the cats could traverse and tunnels, and it was beautiful. It was so colorful. And that is before enrichment became something that people really talked about. The cats actually do better in homes where they have opportunities to go places, to climb, to hide, actually. And he provided all these. He photographed it. It was a groundbreaking book. And then he had some other books that came out after that. And he has a new book out. And we'll talk about the old books. We'll talk about the new book, where a Chihuahua joins his household. That's next week on WGN. Dr. Christine Calder, among other things, a veterinary behaviorist and also co-editor with Pat Coven of Low Stress Handling, A Practical Guide to Cooperative Care, Training, and behavior modification. And I want to talk about this book now. And I had the honor, you asked me when you learned that I knew and sometimes even worked with Dr. Sophia Yin, that, okay, maybe Steve can write the foreword and tell the story about Kitten Kindergarten. I did. Thank you for that. What is Kitten Kindergarten? We've been talking about dogs. Well, you put a shock collar around a cat. I suggest that cat's not going to be your friend tomorrow. You'll get the middle digit in return for that. But and no one would think of doing that. I sure would hope not. However, getting cats off or kittens on the right paw, is that something that you think is a good idea? This crazy notion.
Yes, most definitely, yes. I mean, you know, cats are amazing. Like, they are, they're an amazing species. They're unique, you know, and they are, you know, we're taking cats and we're having them live in our homes. And I think that, you know, sometimes it's hard for the cats. You know, they're just, you know, they have some pretty specific behaviors that are cat-like. And I think things like Kitty Kindergarten really, they're not only fun, right? Because they, you know, you get to play with kittens. That's amazing. But it also sets the cat owner or the cat caregiver as well as those kittens up for success of living in that new home. And it's a wonderful opportunity to provide that opportunity for socialization. You know, kittens have a very short socialization window, so giving them those opportunities to meet different people, to have some playtime with other cats, can really be beneficial in the long run for their overall behavior as they move on into adulthood. And so offering things like Kitty Kindergarten, you know, is a great opportunity to learn about what makes your kitten a cat, and also about, you know, building relationships with other cat caregivers and your veterinary hospital, and, you know, and really preparing them for life in the long run, and making sure that we're meeting all of the basic needs of our cat companions.
You know, maybe the most important thing you can teach a dog, I think, is to come when called, because that can save a dog's life, potentially. And you do have a section here on recall. And if you wrote the book, I don't know, 35 years ago, I think that it would be a completely different response or a completely different explanation about how to teach your dog. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, you can also teach cats to come when called, too.
What?
Very important skill as well.
Yeah, you know what? I agree with that. You know, so let's say, and I'll get back to the dog in a second, but let's say there is a tornado coming to your home, you know, or a flood, or, you know, the gas is going to be out and you have to evacuate, whatever, and you need to call the cat. You don't have a shot at it. If the air raid sirens are going off, the cat knows you're panicked and you're running all over the place, at least have that recall in place. So the way in which I think we could talk about both species in a way here, you tell me if I'm wrong, but I think essentially the learning theory is the same, and the idea in the way you teach either cat or dog to come when called is similar. Am I right, and can you explain?
Oh, yes, definitely. Well, first thing you have to do is establish that, you know, you have a good relationship with it, whether cat or dog, right? So that you mean good things. You always predict good things, right? So that's really the most important. That's the most important part. That's the first step, is that, you know, you are the predictor of fun things. You are the predictor of good things. You produce positive emotions, right? And so that's something that I think is really important. And, you know, if we're punishing them, then, you know, we've already damaged that relationship. But in terms of teaching them to come a call, yeah, first we have to make sure that they, whenever they're in close proximity to us, they come on their own. You know, we're reinforcing that behavior and making sure that it's always on a positive note. And that's really the first step. And once you've established that, that's when you start to add in, you know, the cues. So whenever we're teaching any behavior, we want to make sure that, you know, we don't actually teach them the word. We don't teach them to come. We don't teach them to sit. We don't teach them down. We actually shape and capture the behavior. So we wait for it to happen, or, you know, we reinforce them for, you know, proximity or small little small little behaviors that are close to that end behavior that we want. And then once we get that, about 80% of the time, we're getting the behavior, like they're coming 80% of the time or they're sitting 80%. Then we start to name it. And then we can take it to that next level where we start to use it, you know, to call them from a different room or across the room, you know, all of those, and then reinforce them each and every time that they come. And if they don't come, don't punish them. We want to make sure that's really important as well, is don't punish them if they don't. It just usually means if they don't come when they're called, there might be something else in the environment that's way more distracting or way more interesting than you at that moment. And you may need to take it a few steps back and go back to the drawing board and go back a few steps and start the process over again. So I think that's something that's really, you know, important as well.
I would argue most cats already do come when they're called by the refrigerator or the can opener. So they hear that certain sound. They know you're opening salmon, sardines, tuna, whatever that is that they like. And especially if you have a history of giving them some of that, they are going to come when called, I think.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. Especially if you shake the treat bag, right? What do we do when they accidentally get outside? Like sometimes we go out there and shake the treat bag as we call their name, right? So, but yes, that's all classical conditioning. They start to make associations with certain noises, you know, the can opener, the cabinet opening, the pantry opening, you know, you walking into the kitchen, you know, all of those noises or your behavior can actually, they actually will learn to associate that with positive things and coming to you. And so, yeah, you're exactly right. We're already, Most of the time, it's a lot easier than we think, and then we can just take it from there because a lot of times they already have, you know, the foundations in place. We just need to build it out a little bit more.
And with dogs, the next thing to do is to take them outdoors where there are going to be distractions, mm-hmm. Smells and sounds and all the rest, and use a long leash at first.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So whenever you're working on behaviors or teaching new behaviors, you want to start in a very low distraction environment. You know, we can't expect, you know, our dogs to come to us when there's a squirrel or, you know, a good smell over here. We need to really start and build and proof that behavior in a non-distracting, you know, comfortable, familiar environment. And once we get that behavior in that environment, then we can start to add more challenges in place. And yes, always as we are transitioning into outside or other locations, we should always have some kind of management or safety measures in place. And so at first using a long leash can be really helpful when it comes to, you know, just making sure we've got some kind of security or safety measure in place as we move through the process of adding in those distractions.
Well, the name Cooperative Care is in the book. We're going to learn about what cooperative care is all about. The book, Low Stress Handling, A Practical Guide to Cooperative Care, Training, and Behavior Modification. Dr. Christine Calder will be right back on WGN. Veterinary behaviorist Dr. Christine Calder is here. Good morning, Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN with low stress, no stress, removing stress. It's actually called Low Stress Handling, A Practical Guide to Cooperative Care, Training, and Behavior Modification. What is cooperative care, Dr. Calder?
Cooperative care is when you have active participation from that animal. So they're participating in their own care. So they're telling you that, yes, I am okay with you giving me that injection. I am okay with you trimming my nails. It's about listening to them and hearing their voice and giving them some say in these procedures.
All right, let's talk about one of those procedures. So if I say, and I will right now, that you can get your cat or dog to say, I don't mind that my nails are being cut by you, probably people are laughing as I say that because they don't believe it. But I do believe it can happen. It takes a little effort. I do think you probably think the same thing. So let's talk through how people can do that, Dr. Calder.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, there's different levels of cooperative care. And so one of the first and easy ways is just make sure you're always pairing those types of procedures or, you know, like clipping nails with something good. So give them something, you know, give them something that they can lick on. Give them a churro for talking about cats. But, you know, just making sure that we're pairing whatever we're doing with something good or something that they find positive. So that's, you know, that's one of the easiest ways. And starting that out when they're young, you know, right from the beginning, we're always pairing handling, touching of the feet, you know, anything that we're doing that, you know, might be somewhat uncomfortable for that animal, we need to be pairing it with something good in the beginning. And then for the more challenging cases, what we actually tend to do is we actually teach them a way to tell us or talk to us or signal to us that they're okay with that procedure. And those are called start button or start signal behaviors. So, for instance, in terms of if we've got a dog, let's say, that is uncomfortable with nail trims, we don't go right to trimming their nails. We actually teach them or work on a start button behavior first. And that might be a chin rest where they rest their chin on our hand, on a bench, on a towel. Or we might teach them to lay on their side and then put their head down. But these are start signals or start button behaviors. And they can say, yes, I'm ready for you to move to the next step. And if at any moment they lift their head or they don't get onto the mat, then that's a clear no. And we need to respect that. But if they continue on with the yes, then we can go to that next step where we might work on desensitizing them to touching their feet and then adding in the nail clippers and things like that. So it's a process. So, you know, that's what true cooperative care is giving these animals that voice to say yes and giving these animals that voice to say no. And knowing that when they tell us no, that we are going to respect that. And when they tell us yes, then we know that we've got a clear signal to move forward. And that's true cooperation from these animals.
You know, if my boss here wants me to cooperate, maybe my boss would pay me a few more bucks, you know? So if we were to pay our pets a little bit with treats they really love, can that be helpful as well?
Oh, most definitely. Most definitely. We're not going to work for free, right? And neither are they. So, you know, food is really important, right? It's an important, what we call a primary reinforcer, right? So most will work for food. Sometimes play is a very powerful reinforcer. So, you know, it may not always be about food. Sometimes play is part of that as well. But, you know, those are two things. The other really important reinforcer is choice. You know, having a choice and having a voice. And I think that's something that sometimes we don't always recognize. But when we don't give them that choice, then we take away that ability to have a voice. And so that can sometimes be can be aversive to them. So making sure they've got choice, using food as a way to pay them, and or toys and play as well, depending on what motivates them. And each animal is going to be different, and we may need to try out a few things to see what is most motivating for that individual.
And it depends where their fear level is at. So as you point out, if we're talking about clipping nails, if you're starting with a puppy or a kitten, much easier because they've not had a previous, by their perspective, bad experience. But if you're starting with a 3-year-old dog who's always has run the other way when you take out the nail clippers, what I tell people, by the way, is to, number one, put the nail clipper in a completely different place so they are not predicting bad things are happening when you go to that drawer over there. And secondly, if you can, even get a different pair of nail clippers and put that nail clipper on the floor like a piece of furniture, except it becomes a treat dispenser as well. And they don't have that negative association at the very start. And it's at the very start, to me, that makes the biggest difference. Same thing with brushing teeth, it's this, or anything you teach, I think. What do you think?
Oh, definitely, definitely. You can also teach them to target, too.
Yeah.
Right? Like, so we can teach them to target the nail clippers. We can teach them to target a toothbrush. Like, you know, that way also, you know, it's something that they can control whether or not they interact with it or not. And so that helps them to make positive associations as well. But you're exactly right. I mean, just making it, you know, a part of the everyday. And also, you know, dogs, cats, they're, you know, just like we were talking about coming when called, you know, they know when you're opening the drawer, they know when you're opening the can, they know where you put those toenail clippers, especially if they have a negative association with them. So, you know, making them, you know, bringing them out, putting them in a different location so that it doesn't always predict when you go to that particular drawer, something bad is going to happen. And I think, you know, that's important, just like cats and carriers. right? You know, what do people do? They leave the carrier in the basement, or it's in the attic, or it's in the garage, and they only bring it out when it's time to go to the vet hospital. Well, that's a scary thing for the cat, right? So, you know, if you make it part of their day-to-day environment, then it's a whole lot less scary, and it doesn't predict bad things. And so, you know, and I think that is the first step, right, is we've got to try to avoid the fearful triggers for these particular behaviors. And so if we can make these things a part of their day-to-day or normal environment, then they're less likely to be fearful of them or really, you know, suspicious of, you know, these things in their environment and the things that you're doing with them. And I think that's important.
It is Low-Stress Handling, a practical guide to cooperative care, training, and behavior modification. Dr. Christine Calder co-edited the book with Pat Coven. Dr. Calder, people can get the book at Cattle Dog Publishing, I believe?
They can, CattleDogPublishing.com, and soon it should be also on Amazon as well.
CattleDogPublishing.com. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. Congratulations on another great book, and probably by next Tuesday you'll have still another one out. Thank you, Dr. Calder.
No, we don't have another one coming soon. But yes, thank you. Thank you so much. Thanks so much for having me.
It's always good to talk to you. And thank you for spreading this good and really important information. Once again, Low Stress Handling, a practical guide to cooperative care training and behavior modification. Thank you, Dr. Calder. Who knew there's a forecast for this stuff? But the Companion Animal Parasite Council, they do that. They forecast where the ticks will be and how many there will be. And not only does this affect our dogs, it affects all of us. Dogs, in fact, are a sentinel for tick disease for all of us. There's a species that was introduced to America back in 2017 called the Asian long-horned tick that experts are still trying to figure out exactly what disease processes that this tick causes. It's not yet hit the Chicago area or Illinois, but it's on its way. I'll tell you, though, Lyme disease this year in Chicago or around the metro area is expected to be worse than it ever has been. So please talk with your veterinarian about protection for your dog. We can do more to protect our dogs, actually, than we can ourselves. We'll talk to you next week, bright and early on WGN.